From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. Imagine spending most of your life in prison for a crime you didn't commit.
I went to death row simply because I was born black, male, and poor. I went to the death row because the prosecutor was racist.
Today we meet Anthony Hinton, an Alabama man who spent nearly three decades on death row. He was eventually exonerated. Just ahead, he looks down his long road ahead. But first, we talked a while ago about school choice.
More controversial issue right now is charter schools. Charters have been part of the Georgia landscape for more than a decade now. You know, they are doing no more better, no more worse than most of our public schools. And they are part of the public school system. It's tax dollars that support those. But what really is controversial and more controversial are the vouchers. That's where you take public tax dollars that were set aside for your kid to educate your kid in public school systems, and you can send those dollars to a private school.
That's Atlanta Journal-Constitution education editor Christopher Quinn. We asked you what you think about school choice. Here are your first thoughts.
Hi, my name is Regina McDuffie. I'm from Macon, Georgia. And I think that although it's not an intended consequence, segregation is a result of the school choice. And what that does is leave the people who do not have the choice or cannot make the choice in the public school system.
We always want to know what you think. Give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the program. May is Older Americans Month. We're taking a look at the state of senior health care in Georgia. According to a report last year from the United Health Foundation, Georgia is the 41st state in the nation for its quality of senior health. That's down two slots from the year before. So what is the general health of Georgia's senior citizens, and what's being done to address elder abuse? I talked about this with two guests. Kathy Floyd is the executive director of the Georgia Council on Aging, and Glenn Oster is director of the Institute of Gerontology at the University of Georgia. We spoke last year. Glenn, you say Georgia is bad when it comes to community and environment engagement. How does that lack of engagement factor into elder abuse?
Well, I think it's everything is connected. So, yes, there's lack of engagement at the community level, and that is perhaps a process from both the top down and bottom up. The top down meaning what can our institutions, governments, and so forth do to better regulate the industry and make sure that there are qualified people who are well-educated, who understand their position and their role in looking after elders. But it also, from the bottom up, so to speak, on the individual level and the family level, is there's an education and awareness that needs to be put in place so people understand the dynamics of when your loved one is in a, whether it's an assisted living facility or a nursing home, that there's certain things that take place, and that if both sides are better educated, again, from the top down and bottom up, on what really is important to both sides in providing really good quality of care, and have sort of a meeting of the minds of both sides and saying this is, you know, having some metrics in place and standardizations on trying to improve the care so everyone benefits, both the employer, the employee, and also the person, the consumer, receiving the benefits of that care.
Kathy, what, from your perspective, is the problem with the quality of care for seniors in Georgia?
Well, you have, with our rankings, you do have a low ranking for nursing home quality, and that is definitely an issue in Georgia. But part of the reason for that is that we have one of the lowest Medicaid reimbursement rates in the country. Almost 80% of nursing home beds are paid for with Medicaid. And so when you pay less, you get less. And so one of the things that we need to do, frankly, is increase that reimbursement rate and tie it to quality. And one of the things that we're looking at is having The direct care workers, those folks that do the majority of the hands-on work, paid at least $10 an hour. And we think that is a possible way to get at some of these problems.
Well, you also say that seniors have not really been a focus of lawmakers. I know that's something that you're working on. Kathy, what does it look like if lawmakers are more engaged on this?
Well, we have seen a difference in just the last couple of years. They've funded the creation of a position for a statewide prosecutor. You have different counties that are, you know, able to do different things. Frankly, here in the metro area, Cobb County is excellent. They do a great job. But a smaller county doesn't have the resources. So this statewide prosecutor will be able to go into different counties and be able to help them prosecute the wrongdoers. And that's a win-win. One of the things we're looking at doing is asking all of the major candidates for governor to make senior issues a priority.
You know, Glenn, I want to get back to this question of education. You know, we should all be so lucky to live long enough to live a life where we have great care around us as we age. What is it that we need to know as we age, and what do our family members need to know in terms of making sure that great quality of care is available?
Well, I think a part of education is an awareness of the various factors. And both, when I say factors, I mean awareness and education, both formal and informal education, of those factors that will diminish our quality of life, but also looking at factors and having people have this awareness of what can they do when they're younger to have sort of over a life course, so they hopefully insure themselves or at least give themselves a greater opportunity to age well or to have that quality of life. So I think education is a major, major part of it.
Is that education, Glenn, sorry to interrupt, but is that education readily available? I mean, is it easily accessible?
I would think not. And when I speak of education, that could be ongoing campaigns, you know, from the government level. It could be starting right in our classrooms and educating those in grade school and high school and university about the process of aging and aging well and some of the factors that they may encounter as they age as they see their parents age or grandparents age. This really should be a priority, you know, because right now about 15% of the U.S. population is 65 or older.
Yeah, yeah.
Within a decade or two, that's going to be 20, 21, 22%. We need to invest resources. We need to have awareness of how to handle various situations.
That's Glenn Oster, director of the Institute of Gerontology at UGA. You also heard Kathy Floyd. She's executive director of the Georgia Council on Aging. Let's continue our focus on our aging population by talking about a major life decision, retirement. Last month, the Insured Retirement Institute released a study that found 42% of baby boomers do not have retirement savings. What are the steps needed to ensure a meaningful retirement? My colleague Celeste Headley talked about this with financial author Carrie Hannon.
Carrie, can you start by explaining, people keep talking about comfortable retirement. This is what you need to have. What does comfortable retirement mean?
Good question. I think it's clearly different for everyone, what you want and expect in your retirement years. But truthfully, you know, the point that I make in a lot of my work is that, in fact, you know, part of everyone, I think, most people's retirement moving forward, work is going to be a piece of that. And I think that's become a pillar of our retirement plans. And it's not work as a four-letter word. It's work part-time, seasonal, whatever, to kind of help you get through this period of time and doing work that you enjoy.
So take a listen to this comment. This is Pat Walsh of Buckhead, and he's trying to figure out what the magic number is.
I have no idea what the number would be now. I'm aware that the The consumer price index and the world itself changes dramatically, so the cost of living and the cost of doing things rises. And expectations are higher, I think, among young people today. That would drive their required number up.
Is he correct, Carrie? Has the so-called magic number you need for retirement changed?
You know, I think in a certain respect it has, but you got to remember that, you know, I'd encourage people, take a look at what you're spending today and do a budget of what your costs are today and figure it's going to be about the same amount in retirement. You don't really have less. Your expenses change. I mean, your medical costs are going to ramp up, but there may be some other things that aren't as much. But a good way to figure it out is sort of look at where you are today, how much you're spending, and factor in a little inflation for each year you think you're, and then the crystal ball, how long are we going to live? So it's really tough, but that's just a way to kind of get a grip. But most importantly, most people never take the time to even run one of those calculators, which they're online, they're easy to do. And even if you just plug in a few things, the ballpark estimate gets you thinking about saving and thinking about what you might need.
We're talking about the best ways to prepare for retirement. And as I mentioned, we asked folks around Georgia to tell us how much they think they need to retire comfortably. Here's what they said.
My name is Rebecca Frankson, and I live in Atlanta, Georgia. If I had to put a number on the amount of money that I needed for retirement, I believe our financial advisors told us it was upwards of $1 million, which just seems unattainable at this point.
My name is Alicia Blakely, and I live in Decatur, Georgia. I guess on an annual basis, anywhere from $50,000 to $75,000.
My name is Kelly Sanderson. I live in Villarica, Georgia. Price tag on retiring comfortably, you know, I'm honestly not sure. Like, if I had to take a guess, I would say $80,000 to $100,000, maybe, just so I can travel and everything later in life.
$80,000 to $100,000. I imagine, Carrie, your first thought is, wow, is she underpricing that?
Well, it's yes, but that at least she's thinking about it, and that's the most important thing. And the younger you are when you start thinking about this, the better shot you have if you can start socking some away, because it compounds and it grows without you having to worry about it. If you can put it in some retirement accounts, there's some good target age funds that people can invest in that kind of, you can, you know, get it automatically going for you. So the younger you can start, the better, because the numbers do compound and they can get big over time. So I don't want to be a, you know, squashing that. The fact that she's thinking about it, I think, is really great.
Carrie, how much Social Security can the average millennial hope to collect? How much can someone rely on Social Security? Not enough to sustain them, right?
No, I don't think. You know, the program was never designed to be that way. It's really, it's just part of sort of that, we all refer to it as your, sort of your three-legged stool. You know, you have that, you have your retirement savings from an employer plan or a pension, and you have your own personal savings. And now I add that fourth pillar, work, which it really provides the whole package for you. So I wouldn't, I personally feel they're going to have Social Security there for them. I think there's nothing to worry about from that perspective, but it's not going to be a huge chunk every month. It's just going to be a piece of what you need to have put aside. It's important if you think you don't have enough money, like to spare anything to put away, even if you can do a little bit, a lot of employer plans, or you can even do your own automatic, taking it out of your paycheck and putting it in an IRA, but you can have an escalation clause, so you start small, and then as you you can ramp that up as you start earning some more or you feel more comfortable.
That's financial author Carrie Hannon speaking with my colleague Celeste Headley. And we want to hear from you. How are you going about retirement planning? You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk. It's on Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. Yesterday, we shared the story of Willie McGee. He was a black man executed 67 years ago this month in Laurel, Mississippi. He was convicted of raping a white woman, but he claimed the sex was consensual. His trial and execution drew national attention and generated much discussion about capital punishment. Very few people on death row have been released from prison, but our next guest was. He joins us to share his story of wrongful incarceration, eventual freedom, and abiding hope. In 1985, a restaurant outside Birmingham, Alabama was robbed. Its manager shot and wounded. He identified Anthony Hinton as his assailant, and police pinned two other robberies of fast food restaurants on Hinton. In those incidents, the store managers were shot and killed. Anthony Hinton was 29 years old at the time, and he spent the next 30 years in prison, mostly on death row. But with the help of civil rights attorney Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative, Hinton was released in 2015. His book, The Sun Does Shine, describes his ordeal. Anthony shared his story with my colleague, Adam Ragusea.
Were you thinking about how you would eventually tell your story one day when you were on death row? Were you writing this book in your head? Did you think you'd be able to give the world your side of this story at some point?
Well, I had hoped so. You know, one never knows when they're dealing with the legal system. I did know that the legal system had made, I would love to be able to say a mistake, but the legal system didn't make a mistake on my case. I went to death row simply because I was born black, male, and poor. I went to the death row because the prosecutor was racist. But once I got to death row, I began to think about everything that my mom had taught me about fairness, compassion, and everything. But I never thought that I would end up on death row for a crime that I didn't commit. I didn't even think the races of the racist person that stand for justice would openly put an innocent man on death row. But make no mistake about it, they did, and they knew that I was not the person that had committed that crime. In fact, one of the detectives told me, he said, I don't believe you did it. He said, but you'll do. And I looked at that detective with tears coming down my eyes, and another detective told me and say, listen, we really believe you didn't do it. But since y'all are always taking up for one another, take this rap for your homeboy. And I told that detective, there's not a homeboy in this world that I would take a rap for like this. And so they knew that those bullets didn't match. They didn't care. Was quoted as the prosecutor once said, we didn't get the right one, but at least we got one off the street.
It was your own defense team. You write in the book
Absolutely.
That your defense
Absolutely.
Attorney told you, all y'all blacks always say you didn't do something. That was your defense
Yes.
attorney that said that to you.
Absolutely. You know, it was like the good old boys had got together and decided that we would do just enough to make the legal system seem like we went through the proper procedure. But how would you feel if your attorney come up and don't even speak to you and just look at you and say, I didn't go to law school to do pro bono work. And I never will forget it. I looked at him and I said, would it help if I told you that I was innocent? And he looked at me and he said, the problem with that statement is all of y'all is always doing something and then saying you didn't do it. And this is the attorney then that I knew that I had to somehow try to win over and make him like me where he would at least give me the representation that I deserved. But it didn't work, and, you know, and he went out and hired a blind ballistic expert. I often tell people the truth. Had I been on the jury, I would have found me guilty because the expert that he went out and got was no expert indeed. And what bothers me more than anything is that the judge allowed this so-called civil engineer, the judge qualified him as being one of the best experts that you could get. And so I knew then that once they start cross-examining him, that I would be found guilty. And it cost me 30 years of my life.
Anthony, I don't know why this is the detail that sticks at me. It just does. In your book, you write how you needed this racist defense attorney. You considered him your Rocky. He was your Italian fighter. And mm-hmm. then and you were Apollo Creed. And then you write about how 10 years later, I imagine in prison, you saw Rocky IV for the first time. And tell people what you thought when you saw that film.
Well, when I saw it, you know, you always imagine that your attorney will decide that he will give you his best. And realizing that he had made a mistake, and I needed this attorney because I couldn't afford an attorney. And as I said earlier, I had to try to win this attorney over to get him to like me. It wasn't about being able to pay him where he come from. I could tell that this attorney was racist. I could tell that this attorney have put every black man in this box. And far as he was concerned, I was no different, no better. I had went out and did a horrible crime, and he had been asked to represent me. And he didn't want to do it, but the judge told him to do it. And so my way of thinking was, come on, let me be your coach. Let me bring you to victory. Instead of you bringing me to victory, let me try to show you who I really am as a person. Don't look at me for my race. Look at me for an individual. Get to know me. And then I had hoped that once he got to know me as an individual, as a person, he would say, you know what? He's different. He's a person that I can work for, a person that I would give my all for. And I really thought that I could win him over. And when I saw Rocky, you know, I finally said to myself, this is the dream. This is what I had imagined that my attorney would do. He would win my freedom, and we would run up some steps somewhere, and we would throw our hands up in victory and say, hey, you fought a good fight, and we won. And so it just brought back some bad memories when I seen it, and I seen that it wasn't going to work out that way. And I can't even imagine to tell you how it feel, knowing that before you even go to court, you already been judged, you already been found guilty. The only thing now left is the sentence. And every judge and every lawyer for the prosecutor, and even my own lawyer, I felt betrayed, not only me, but they portrayed justice. They portrayed and made a mockery out of the system. And therefore, I don't know how anyone could ever believe in the system. Again, after reading and getting to know my case, I just cannot understand how a simple case like this that dealt with ballistics, how an attorney could go out and hire a one-eyed blind civil engineer. But yet the system allowed this to be who I needed, and they said he was no more than others, and he read and got magazine. And I never will forget when the judge said that, well, he getting magazines and he know more than the average person. I kept thinking, if I was to get medical journal sent to the house, would that give me the right to go out and perform open heart surgery? Because that exactly what she was saying. Just because this man get magazine talking about bullets and guns, he was qualified, and my lawyer went out and hired this man. My lawyer never did give me his best, and I want to say to whoever is listening, I don't care whether you're being paid or not paid, you chose this profession, and you should give every client your best, and sometimes your best won't be good enough. But at least you could go home and say, hey, today I gave Anthony Ray Hinton, today I gave this lady, this man, my best. And I tell you the truth, I never did receive my attorney best. I seen my attorney twice in the year and a half that I sit in jail. And I wanted so badly to believe that my attorney would do what he's supposed to do. And even with him making the racist statement that he had made, I still wanted to believe in him. But more important, I wanted to believe in this system that my mom had taught me to believe in. And I'm going to be honest with you. I don't believe in the system. And I'm going to be honest again with my viewer. It's hard for me to believe that a white man would give me his best. And I can't tell you how hurtful that is for me to sit here and say, because I believe that justice should not be about race. Justice should be about that word, justice.
Yeah, you write in the book about how, again, you were seeing your lawyer like he was going to be your Rocky, and you were going to be his Apollo Creed. And then you say that 10 years later, you actually got to see Rocky IV when you were in prison. And you write, it made me glad that I hadn't known that Apollo Creed died in the movie while Rocky stood by and watched.
I kept wondering, did he really understand it? I had been sentenced to death. Did he really understand that this is a case about the death penalty? This is a case that, no doubt, if I be found guilty, I'm going to be sentenced to death. Did he care enough to give me his all? Did he care enough to say, I'm going to fight for my client, because if I don't, he's going to be sentenced to death, and there's a great possibility that he will be executed. I thought and hoped in my own heart that he would care enough to say, hey, I'm not going to let this man die on my watch. But he didn't. And I wanted so bad to believe that he would be my Rocky.
You've been out of prison for about 3 years now. You write in the book about how your time in prison, you went through quite an arc. You started off very angry. You didn't speak for 4 years. But eventually, primarily through your faith, you really were able to adopt a very positive mindset that got you through hell, as you put it. You've been out of there for 3 years now. How are you feeling?
I feel good. I have great days and bad days. I won't. People to understand that 3 years will not erase 30 years. And for some reason, I still find myself on death row on occasion. I still wake up every morning at about 2:45, and I was woken up every morning for 30 years at 3 a.m. for breakfast. Now I wakes up out of pure habits because that's the time I had to get up in order to eat breakfast. I find myself showering just like I did when I was locked up every other day on a certain occasion. I still live in prison some days, and it feels like I'm just on a furlough. My mind takes me back, especially during the week of an execution. No matter where I am, no matter where and who it is, I be on death row because I know exactly what that week is like, the week of an execution. I know exactly what the condemned is being told, and I know that every inmate that he come across is trying to give him hope. And I sit here in this house, and people don't understand that my heart is heavy, and I'm imagine being in that cell, and I know exactly how the guards is treating him. And they treating him this week like a human being, where for the last 10 years, 20 years, no matter what he asked him for, it was always no. But the week of the execution, the guard will go out his way and treat him like a human being. And I wonder sometimes what it is about death that even makes your enemy love you just before they execute you. And so I go through pure hell someday because of what they did to me for 30 years.
It's interesting. As I talk to you, I realize, well, it's evident in your book as well, that you, Anthony, you're a very intelligent man, and you're very charismatic. And I wonder about all of the people who may have been wrongfully convicted in other cases, and they don't have the tools that you have. They're not as effective advocates for themselves as you are. And I wonder what happens to them.
I'm trying to be their sports person. We can sit here all we want to. We can blame the system, but I blame the voters. I blame the people. Every day, the government kills in your name. And the government kill innocent people. The government kill innocent people knowing that they innocent. But society don't care. Society say you had a trial and you was found guilty. I was found guilty by a jury that the judge told me, a jury of my peers. Now, they got it wrong. Do we really want to kill innocent people? And I often tell people, the only way we will never kill innocent people is that we don't have a death penalty. And the death penalty, the politician need to stop lying to the voters and telling them that they are more safer by having a death penalty. You're no more safer with John Doe being dead than you was when he was alive and locked up in prison. But the problem that we have in this system is that the system is not fair. People see this statue and she got this blindfolds around her eyes, but I promise you, she can see. She know what race you are. She know what college you went to. She know how much money you have in the bank. She know what neighborhood you live in. She know everything she need to know about you. And if you find yourself in her courtroom, she have already put these things together, and it have already been determined whether you're going to be found innocent or guilty. That is a fact. We live in a system that is badly flawed, and I don't understand why people will not wake up and say, hey, too many innocent men and women are being exonerated in this country. How long do we need a death penalty? Because if you truly care about innocent people die every day in this country. I, had it not been for the civil rights attorney, Brian Stevenson, who stepped in and worked diligently and worked every day, 7 days a week, nonstop for 16 years to prove my innocence. If it had not been for him, let me put it in a way that it should be said. Had God not sent this man to me, I surely would not be here talking to you, because the state of Alabama had every intention of killing an innocent man. And they was going to do it in the name of justice. Now, I like to ask the world, I like to ask everybody that's going to listen to this, where is my justice? Where do I go to get justice? Who do I see to get justice? Because it seems like no one cares that I've been locked up in a cage like an animal for 30 years, and every day people look at me and they think I'm fine. But I'm not fine, because I live it every day. And I pray to God that one day that this will just be a blank memory. I don't have no memory of where I've been for the last 30 years.
That's former death row inmate Anthony Hinton speaking with my colleague Adam Ragusea. Anthony's memoir is called The Sun Does Shine. It's on Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. This year's NPR Tiny Desk Contest winner is a Georgia native. Naya Izumi is a 34-year-old musician from Columbus. Just a taste of Naya Izumi's music. These days, he lives in Los Angeles and busks on the city's streets. We'll talk to him tomorrow, but we'd first like to hear from you. Who's a Georgia artist that we should know about? You can give us a call and leave us a message at 404-500-9457, and you can find us on Twitter or Facebook, and then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Renowned novelist Harper Lee died in 2016, but Emory University has brought a little-known part of her past to life. The author of To Kill a Mockingbird wrote a number of letters to friends between 1956 and 1961. Harper Lee's letters were acquired earlier this year by Emory University. Emory historian Professor Joe Crespino says the letters provide a window into her life and her views during a period of tumultuous change in Southern political life. Professor Crespino's latest book is titled Atticus Finch, The Biography. It comes out today, and he's speaking tonight at the Carter Presidential Museum and Library. Joe, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
How many letters are we talking about, and what do we learn about Harper Lee from these letters?
Well, these are a fascinating set of letters in that they are written right before the period in which Harper Lee is about to write her two novels.
Yes.
She writes Ghost of a Watchman first, and then she writes To Kill a Mockingbird. So several of these letters are from 1956, when she is at home in Monroeville with her father, and with her family, but she's there to take care of her father because her father has had his first serious illness. And so one of the things that's fantastic about the letters is that we get to see this relationship between daughter and father, a relationship that clearly influences in a profound way both of the novels that she would end up writing. But there's some really poignant passages from the novels in which they are she's describing kind of what her father means to her.
Yeah.
And so we see her, you know, it's like for a lot of us, right, when we have our parents and they have their first kind of brush with death, we begin to reflect on their lives in new ways, and we kind of take stock of what they've meant to us. And that's what we see her doing in these letters in an interesting way.
So I don't want to get too long in the segment before we hear from one of the letters. So
yeah, I can read right here. This is a great example I'm talking about.
Outstanding.
Yeah. So this is her writing. Daddy is sitting beside me at the kitchen table, fully clothed and eating his 4 o'clock meal. He gets around the house with a walking stick, and Bear will soon drive him out to look at the high water on the golf course. While thinking of something to say to you, I found myself staring at his handsome old face, and a sudden wave of panic flashed through me, which I think was an echo of the fear and desolation that filled me when he was nearly dead. It has been years since I have lived with him on a day-to-day basis, and these months with him have strengthened my attachment to him, if such is possible. If he gets along every day like this, like he has today, it won't be long before I'll be back with you.
Mm. Joe, how long have we known about the existence of these letters? And I'm wondering what other memorabilia is part of this collection.
Well, one of the things that's we've known the letters for a little bit. I mean, they were held by a private rare books dealer. And I came across them when I was doing research for my book. And I knew I wanted to look at them because what's great about them is we don't have a lot from Harper Lee during this particular period. In the late 1950s. And so that's what's interesting about them, and that's what's important about them. But one of the things that's great about them, too, is we can put them alongside other sources. For example, when we know that she's home in 1956, now we can go and do research in the local newspaper. And that's one of the things I've done to look at kind of what's going on in Monroeville. And this is a very critical moment in the history of the civil rights movement in the Deep South.
Yeah.
Well, what's going on in Alabama is that kind of the era of massive resistance is really starting up full bore. 1956 is a critical year for Alabama. You've got Arthurine Lucy is the first African-American woman who's coming into the University of Alabama. That's calling all kinds of struggles. There's the boycott in Montgomery that's been going on, that is playing out in the Supreme Courts. So this is causing all kinds of reactionary politics to emerge in Alabama and the Deep South. And this is when, politics in the South are really polarizing, and you begin to see the rise of an organization like the Citizens Councils, the White Citizens Councils, right? And this is supposedly the kind of the white-collar Klan. These are the responsible folks who are supposed to kind of keep down the hotheads and lead this kind of peaceful resistance to the civil rights movement. But that's not happening. And what's happening in Alabama in 1956 and 57 and 58, when she's writing these novels and then revising them, is it's not the kind of the moderate white citizens councils that's keeping the Klan in check, but really what's happening is the Klan is radicalizing the moderates and the white citizens councils. And so in some ways, I think this process of what's happening on the ground in Alabama is really shaping the context of how she's revising her two novels.
So I want to get to a soundbite from Harper Lee in a moment, but first, if you're just joining us, we're having a fascinating conversation with Joe Crispino from Emory University. The university acquired the letters from Harper Lee, and they're now available to the public. Joe, how important are these letters, and how great is it to be able to make them available to the public?
Well, it's wonderful because Harper Lee is such a beloved figure, and the novel To Kill a Mockingbird is really one of kind of America's shared stories. So many people read that and they're assigned it because it's a book that we want to teach kids about kind of racial morality, and it's how kids learn. But now we have a way of kind of knowing more about the context in which she's writing that novel, right? And that's important. So we can kind of enrich our understanding of her literature and its importance and think in more complicated ways about its relevance for us today.
That's author and historian Joe Crispino from Emory University. The university acquired letters from author Harper Lee. They are now available to the public in the Rose Library at Emory. Joe has just finished his book, Atticus Finch, the biography, which comes out today. You can hear Joe speak tonight at 7 o'clock at the Carter Presidential Museum and Library. That conversation tonight will be moderated by GPB's Bill Knight. And now let's head to the theater. This month marks National Historic Preservation Month, and we are delighted to take you to two historic theaters in our state. Our first stop is the Morton Theater in Athens. It's a place theater director Lynn Green loves dearly.
My heart is sad and I'm all alone. My man treats me mean. I regret the day that I was born and that man I ever seen.
As a University of Georgia fifth-year senior, I was involved in the university's Black Theatrical Ensemble. There was a show that I was supposed to do in the Morton, and everyone spoke about the Morton and the Morton and the Morton. And that was the very first time I actually stepped foot on site. And I was stunned. Again, I had been in Athens for many years, and somehow I had missed that gem was sitting there in the corner. right after I graduated UGA, I had gone through school just straight through working or going to school, and I never really had a break. So my big, wonderful plan was the minute I graduated, I was going to travel the world and, you know, then figure out what I wanted to do next. I think I made it as far as Arizona, and then we made a day trip to Las Vegas, and I got a phone call. The job at the Morton opened up. Come home. So I immediately packed my things and came home and applied for the job, and I did get it, and that's how I got my foot in the door. About 3 years ago, we had the floors redone as part of this wonderful effort right around the centennial of the building. And the original floors that Pink Morton himself laid were the original floors there, of course. But upstairs, there were just a few planks that didn't quite survive the new floor. And you know, there might be a plank of the original wood floor that's in a frame at my house.
That's Lynn Green. She's the director of the Morton Theater in Athens. Now let's travel about 2.5 hours away to the DeSoto Theater in Rome, Georgia. We meet a man whose own family history is bound to the history of the DeSoto.
My name is Tommy Lamb, and I'm an interior designer in Rome, Georgia. My grandfather, Mr. O.C. Lamb Sr., was the builder and founder of the DeSoto Theater. He built the theater in 1929 as the first talking motion picture in the Southeast. I think it was the most amazing thing for everyone to first, you know, see a motion picture that had sound associated. It was also the first theater in the Southeast to have air conditioning. So it was a wonderful place to get away from the heat and enjoy a movie. I think that at that time, you know, Westerns were very popular. You know, most of them dealt with a saloon and a boyfriend and a girlfriend, you know, and dealing with Indians and things of that sort. That's pretty much what they were.
Why should we have to ask an Indian every time we want to get some buffalo meat? They're running wild around here.
Yes, but these happen to be on Indian territory.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to get me a buffalo. There's plenty for everybody.
White man, forget promise. Kill our buffalo.
You know, at that time, cereals were very popular. Lots of short films were shown, cartoons.
There's a little queen on the animated screen. Wait till you get a view of sweet Betty, made of penne.
During the Depression, people, you know, had a hard time affording much of anything. I think admission to the theater was a nickel at that time. So it was an escape from the everyday doldrums that were going on around them.
America goes to war. Men of the Army, Navy, and Marines reinforce the battlefronts on 6 continents to save the homes and ideals of free men from Axis domination.
During World War II, the theater actually sold war bonds, and there were discounts to get people to buy the war bonds, you know, so you could get so many points toward the war bonds, you know, by buying tickets to the theater.
I woke up this morning with my
African Americans were allowed to come to the theater. Unfortunately, at that time, they had to go in a side entrance and sit in the balconies. They were not allowed to sit on the main floor of the theater, which was true with most theaters. There in Rome at that time, there actually was one African-American theater, the Carver Theater, which is no longer in existence.
Freedom, walking and talking with my man, Lord.
maids could certainly, and household servants could certainly bring children, you know, to the theater, but they were not allowed to sit with them. They had to sit in the balconies. They had to take a side entrance up, and they could not buy things at concession stands, you know, at that time either. We were very spoiled as children. You know, we would gather up all of our friends and take them into the movie free and, you know, take charge of the theater. And I'm sure we were a manager's nightmare. Probably the most fun things were like The Nutty Professor as a child with Jerry Lewis, John Wayne movies were all great fun. You know, and then, of course, Walt Disney's movies as they came along.
Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in a most delightful way.
I think that DeSoto will always remain an integral part of Rome's society and will be a building that is used now more so than ever before. It was built with a style to last through the ages, and that it's just a building that people will always remember for good times and for pleasant memories. And so I think it's found a new role, you know, from its past to make it into what it is today, that it is no longer just a motion picture theater, but a center for all sorts of types of arts and entertainment in Rome.
That's Tommy Lamb. His grandfather started the DeSoto Theater in Rome. Both that story and the one before it about Athens Morton Theater were produced by GPB's Sean Powers. We highlighted both of these historic theaters to mark National Historic Preservation Month. And that's our show for today. But as always, we want to hear from you. Is there a landmark in your community that you think is worth saving? Tell us about it. Give us a call. 404-500-9457 is the number. Or you can post on Twitter or Facebook. We're at OST Talk. Our show is produced by Findlay Foxen, LaRaven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is our senior producer. Don Smith edits the show, and Tanya Ott is the executive producer. Our engineer is Tyler Morris. Special thanks to our interns, Emmanuel Johnson, Emily Bunker, and Reed Williams. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Tony Harris. Have a great day.